For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way towards salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. Or in the words of Paul, at present we see indistinctly, as in a mirror, but then face to face. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave.
Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, the two most educated Neanderthals you're ever going to run into, Mr. Mark Tuttle and Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Guys, talking about education, it's that time of year with pomp and circumstance and all the robes and the mortar boards and everyone walking.
The funny hats.
Yeah, exactly. Walking across the dais and picking up their sheepskin and, you know, their bill for their school debt.
Ooh, so, yes. Ouch. Yes. You know,
most of these kids are coming out with the idea that, hey, I've got my diploma, give me the paycheck. Well, is there a good place for them to go to make sure that they're going to get that paycheck, or can we kind of steer them some direction? I mean, you know, honestly, guys, nothing against philosophers, but the only people I see making really decent money and might even not be that with a philosophy degree are those who are teaching philosophy. So, you know, where do kids go when they're getting out of school? They've got that degree. Maybe, you know, maybe they got that business degree. That kind of gives them a wide range of places where they go. Well, what do they do with that?
Well, the two aren't mutually exclusive. I mean, you don't have this world of philosophy and world of morality and then the real world of finance of that. I mean, there's a mixture here, and there's a place and a need for more philosophy within the world of finance and money and all of that. And also, of course, I'm always for more money being thrown within the world of philosophy and morality and ethics and virtue.
Yes.
But, you know, this show is going to be all about the interplay of virtue, of ethics, of Catholicism, and money. You know, money sometimes gets a bad name within Catholic circles, but really at its root, the use of money, capitalism, the ability to take the wealth that we've created and do something good with it. This is a very Catholic activity.
It is. It certainly is. You know, I think everyone recognizes there are far more important things in life than money and finance. But money and finance, though, also have a way of weaving themselves through all sorts of aspects of our life. So I think I'm thinking here of how our own personal finances can contribute to or detract from our sense of security, of well-being, of hopefulness for the future, because we're able to plan and save for, say, retirement or children's education or taking care of an elderly parent. These are ways in which money, finance, really do contribute to human flourishing. And we have to extend that, too, to the kind of institutions that provide those kinds of services for us.
Exactly. And we were joking about the debt load that these students are incurring to go to college. And yeah, they're paying a personal price, you know, through interest for having loaned this money. But really, for the vast majority of people, the only way they're able to go and get this education, and, you know, ideally this is an education in not just their future profession, but an education that's going to incorporate philosophy, morality, virtue, ethics, a worldview, all the things we talk about on this show. All of that, there's an investment that's made, and that investment, to be able to make it, there has to be capital and money available for a student to be able to borrow.
Well, a lot of ways, with the political season we have going on right now, I mean, Wall Street has become the great demon. And, you know, anytime you're talking about big finance and these types of things, we run into this idea that, well, that's all evil, that's all bad. Well, you know, a lot of people bring out the old money is the root of all evil. Well, if you really look at the scripture, it doesn't say money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil.
Exactly. So in a little bit, we're going to have on our show Dr. Samuel Gregg. He is the author of a recent book on these topics, For God and Profit. And he's going to help sort all of this out. Tim, help us to be able to get kind of a clearer picture, not only of how the world of finance plays within Catholicism, but also a little bit of the history there, because I think there's some misconceptions to a certain extent of where banking came from, where the world of finance came from. And it's actually a very Christian and very Catholic world, especially in its inception.
Right. And it's capitalism and free markets and trade and commerce are not extrinsic to Christendom, right? And Christian living and Christian civilization, but rather intrinsic to it. Why? Because it contributes to human flourishing because of the wealth creation and investment create these avenues for human ingenuity and contribute to human flourishing, human relationships. Yeah, and Dr. Gregg's going to be the perfect person to talk to about it, because not just for this book, For God and Profit, but his entire work as the director of research there at the Acton Institute, which was founded to promote a free and virtuous society. So it's always this idea of a commercial society and finance, but always within this a society that has a certain kind of morality, certain institutions, certain understandings of law, politics, and religion are all have to be present. And he's going to help us unpack that, and we're going to get at a lot of good things, I think, from his book as well. So please stay tuned to the Catholic Cave, and we'll be right back.
I've got the spirit.
Hi, this is Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection.
Hi, this is Barbara McWiggin, host of The Good Fight here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ray Guarendi, host of The Doctor Is In here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Hi, I'm Al Cresta, and you can join me for Cresta in the Afternoon here on Catholic Radio Indy.
The best of EWTN plus great local programming. That's what you get when you support Catholic Radio Indy.
Ever since we've been on the air at Catholic Radio, we've always wanted to have billboards, but they just don't fit in our budget. And since you'll probably never see a real billboard for us, I'm going to ask you to do something, to imagine one. In your mind, picture a large, empty billboard. Yeah, that's it. Now pick a background color, any color at all. Okay, then across the top of your billboard, put just two words, Catholic Radio. Make them really big. Then, below that in even bigger letters, put 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Wow, that's a great billboard. Now, if this billboard were real, all of your friends and neighbors could see it, and they'd know all about Catholic Radio. But since it's only an imaginary billboard, we're going to have to depend on you to tell your friends about Catholic Radio. Remember, Catholic Radio 89.1 and 90.9 FM. Oh, and by the way, nice choice on that background color. It really looks good.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, and in the cave, we have Mark Tuttle still and Kent Blandford, and it's my great pleasure to welcome back to the program Dr. Samuel Gregg. Welcome, Dr. Gregg.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're delighted. Now, for our listeners may recall, you've been on the program before. You're the Director of Research at the Acton Institute up there in Grand Rapids. Love the Acton Institute. Full disclosure, I've gone to the Acton University the past 6 years and some of the colloquiums up there. And I know that Acton Institute is concerned with liberty and religion, and so we are thrilled to have you on the show. Our listeners also maybe have found some of your work, Dr. Gregg, articles in like Catholic World Report, Crisis Magazine, Public Discourse, but also you're the author of several books, and that's why you're here today, because you have a new book out called For God and Profit, How Banking and Finance Can Serve the Common Good. And so Tell us a little bit about the new book. What's sort of the trajectory of it, the thesis, the theme? Mark and I have had a chance to read it, and just would love to hear a little bit from you about what's going on with For God and Profit.
Well, as I'm sure you know, since 2008 and even before that, the financial sector, the banking sector in the United States and Europe and around the world has had more than its fair share of problems. There's no question, for example, that the financial sector contributed heavily, I think, to the 2008 Great Recession, from which even now, 8 years later, we're still recovering from that. And you find among many Christians, and I should mention that the book is written for an ecumenical audience, among many Christians there's a lot of skepticism about finance, about financial markets, about the financial sector. And some of that skepticism is justified. But what I wanted to do in this book was to show, as the subtitle, which is How Banking and Finance Can Serve the Common Good, how that the financial sector can do precisely that. So that's the first thing. The second thing I wanted to do was to basically trace some of the history of what you might call financial markets. And what you discover is that these things first emerged in a Christian world, in more precisely in a medieval Catholic world. So most of the financial tools that we take for granted today, the different ways in which we use capital, the different ways in which we leverage finance to realize any number of very good economic ends, most of these were developed by Catholic theologians in writing in the medieval and early modern period. Most people don't know that. Most people think that financial markets somehow emerged in the 18th century and they're very much a product of an Enlightenment world. Well, all these things were in place hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And so this is partly because the church was grappling with the usury issue, the issue of whether it was legitimate to charge interest. And when they were exploring these questions, they spent a lot of time asking people involved in the business, people who were running banks, how these things worked, how financial tools work, so that they could give a moral analysis of these things. And so you find, for example, that what we understand as modern banks today, most of them had emerged in terms of sort of conceptual process, in terms of the way that they work as institutions. These had emerged as institutions by 1100, 1200. And this is very important because what it tells us is that financial markets and banking are very, very, very much rooted in the life of the Christian church and, of course, in Christian culture. The other thing I try and do with the book is to show how banking and finance today can work in ways that promote the common good. And that's important because I think among many Christians who are critical of, say, the financial sector, what you discover pretty quickly when you start asking them questions about what they understand to be the financial sector or how banking works, what you discover very quickly is they don't know. In other words, they're often talking about something that they haven't studied in a great deal of detail. So things like speculation, for example. Speculation is generally, among many Christians, a bad word. But when you ask people, what do you mean by speculation, it's very clear that they don't actually understand what it is. And they don't understand how financial speculation or food speculation or speculation on commodity markets actually serves to stabilize prices over the long term, that it allows people to plan out in advance how they're going to spend their resources on particular goods. So farmers, for example, can lock in prices for particular commodities like oil a year and a half in advance, and that allows them to be able to plan these things. So I spent a lot of time trying to show how financial markets, in all these sorts of very unseen ways, contribute to the common good. And then the last thing I do is say, okay, the word vocation is something that Christians take very seriously. And maybe we need to think about how finance and working in banks can be a type of vocation. And I read this very much in the work of Thomas Aquinas, who talks about how there's a particular virtue of liberality, or the Latin word is magnificenza. And the magnificent man is the person who's skilled at using money, skilled at using resources to promote good works. And that's what I think is, in the end, has to be the type of vocation that finance assumes. Now, as I said, there's all sorts of problems in the financial sector, and I go through and talk about some of those. But I also say it's very important to identify real problems, but what are not real problems. And I think in many cases what you find, Christians spend a lot of time talking and thinking and even denouncing what I think are not really problems at the expense of paying attention to what are often problems in the financial sector.
You know, that growth of capitalism kind of within the context of a Christian culture is very much at odds, I think, with what the traditional understanding of where capitalism came from, where finance
right.
came from. You know, Max Weber saw it as an outgrowth of the Protestant Reformation and almost a rejection of the Catholic faith. So that history, I think, is very important to a certain extent to reinstate the Catholic roots of capitalism and finance.
Oh, exactly, because you're right. The people have, even many Catholics have, many misperceptions about the history of these things, the history of capital, the history of capitalism. I can't tell you how many times I've had people say to me, this is particularly true among European Catholics, ironically, they'll say things like, well, you know, capitalism is basically a creation of the Anglo-Saxon Protestant world. And I'll say, do you realize that banks and other institutions that use capital in creative ways, you do realize that these began in Italy, that these things were in place in Italy, in Flanders, in much of Western Europe, 300 years before Luther wrote his 95 Theses and pinned them to the door in Wittenberg. Most people don't know that. Most Catholics don't know that. And when you tell people that, it does change their perception, because suddenly they realize, oh, these things are not foreign to my tradition. They're actually part of my tradition, and in fact, they've come out of my tradition.
We're talking right now with Dr. Samuel Gregg of the Acton Institute about finance, capitalism, and Catholicism, a kind of an odd mixture in most people's mind. But as we've been talking about, you know, the history is there, the facts are there, that finance is actually a very virtuous and Christian thing to do. And there's a promotion of the common good that goes along with finance and capitalism. When we talk about Christian activities, we usually talk about it in the context of virtue and vice. So Dr. Gregg, can you talk a little bit about sort of the virtuous side, kind of what the virtues are that are involved in finance, and what some of the vices are that we often see and, you know, that I guess people can...
Make the headlines.
Exactly. Certainly make the
headlines. Bernie Madoff.
Right. So what are some of the vices that are often involved in finance?
Well, the vices that are associated with the world of finance are the vices that are associated with everything else that can range from greed to intemperate behavior to imprudent behavior to actions that clearly are motivated by self-interest, narrowly conceived rather than a broader sense of self-interest. But they're characteristic of every feature of human life. So it's not as if there are specific vices that are somehow only found in the world of finance and banking. It's true, I think, to say that some of these vices can manifest themselves more powerfully in, say, for example, the financial sector. But they're not really somehow uniquely characteristic of the financial world. Greed can happen in any segment of society. Materialism can happen in any type of So it is true that there are some specific temptations associated with working finance. Materialism is obviously one of them. But again, I think that it's not clear to me that this is somehow super specific of the world of finance. But in terms of the flip side, I think one of the things that finance does very, very well, speaking in terms of moral culture, is that it builds up trust. In fact, if you think about it, most of us are very reluctant to trust or entrust our wealth, our possessions, to people that we don't know. But financial systems and banks, this is their purpose. They basically serve as institutions in which we put our trust so that they secure our capital, they put our capital to work. So, for example, when you put money in an investment fund or you put some capital in the stock market or whatever it happens to be, you're basically engaging in an act of trust that the people that you are entrusting your resources to will do a good job, that they will take reasonable risks in trying to make sure that your capital is put to work and in ways that profit you, but also the people to whom the capital is often lent. So in that sense, the other thing that finance does is that it enables us to realize what the church calls the universal destination of material goods. By that I mean it allows the goods of the world, the material things of the world, to serve everyone. Because think about it, you can't literally sit on top of your wealth and do nothing with it. What one does is you put it in a bank or you invest it where people put that wealth to work for other people. Yet in a way, that means that you retain your ownership of it and that you derive some profit from other people's use of it. That's an almost miraculous thing. But this is not just the economic service that's performed by finance. It's also something that enables a degree of justice to be realized because it does help to realize this universal destination of material goods.
Well, Dr. Gregg, I would love for you to describe a little bit about more. We're all history buffs. A lot of people that are listening are history buffs. Tell us a little bit more about how finance and banking that early beginning around 11th, 12th century, what did that look like? And take us, I know we don't have time to go in depth. That's why we want everyone out there to buy the book, For God and Profit. But take us through a little bit of the history about the last 800 years. What's sort of a quick trajectory on finance, banking, and its relationship to the church and Christian civilization?
Well, I think what's very important to realize is that up until about 900, the year 900, the world was economically a quite static place. Economic growth was not something that was generally characteristic of the ancient world. That's partly because the ancient world, the Roman Empire, didn't generate enough wealth in a creative fashion. It's also because there were very negative views of people who engaged in the world of money, because in the ancient world, the great man was a soldier. The great man was a statesman. It was not someone who was involved in business. But by around about 900, what we see is a number of technological changes and changes in ideas that allowed societies to move from being subsistence level, whereby everyone's basically surviving, to societies in which there was economic growth. As I said, that had something to do with development of new technology. It had to do with the emergence of cities. It had to do with the fact that the world warmed up somewhat at this period of time, which was economically beneficial in terms of agriculture. And so all these factors meant that suddenly there was a certain amount of what we would call today capital. These economies were no longer just subsistence level. They were economies that were creating a certain degree of wealth. And that raised the question, well, what do we do with this extra wealth? What do we do with this capital? And the great innovation, which was, most well expressed by some particular Catholic theologians like Antoninus of Florence or Bernardine of Siena, was to understand that in these conditions of economic growth, money wasn't just a means of exchange anymore. Money was something that could be invested. Money was a form of capital. Money could be productive. And this was very important because what it meant was that the objection to usury or money lending was changed. The reason is that usury meant, the problem with usury was that you were engaged in the practice of lending people something that wasn't productive. Money was primarily a means of exchange. It wasn't seen as something productive. And that was the objection to usury. You were making money out of something that wasn't productive. But in the conditions of economic growth, or what we would call early capitalism, money assumes the characteristics of capital. So some of these theologians spent a great deal of time showing that there were numerous instances in this new economic world in which you could legitimately charge interest, because it's one thing to charge interest on money that's sterile. It's a very different thing when you charge interest on capital. So, for example, if you gave capital to someone else, you lent it to them through a banking institution, you were giving something up. You're basically giving up your use of that capital and giving it to someone else. And so scholastic theologians would say, well, this is a legitimate title to interest because you are basically being paid for the fact that you are giving up something that you could be productive with. So that's, I think, very, very important when it comes to understanding this, what I call the financial revolution that occurred in the Middle Ages. And, of course, this took time to unfold. It didn't happen overnight. But by the early modern period, you have Jesuits and Dominicans in places like Spain and Italy who are writing at length about the development of what we would call today banks and financial markets. And they were spending a lot of time going through and explaining to people what their responsibilities were if they worked in a bank or if they worked in some sort of financial institution, which are all through Europe by this time. And this is because they had people coming to them in the confessionals saying, okay, Father, I've got this dilemma with my money. Is it permissible for me to lend it, et cetera, et cetera? But the really other important thing that happened in this time is that these theologians took the time to try and actually understand how banks and finance works, because they realized we really can't offer moral guidance to people working in these areas unless we actually understand what it is that they actually do. And that, I think, is a lesson that's very important to me, because as I said right at the beginning, I think there's a tendency for many Christians to condemn finance, to be very skeptical of the financial sector, to have very negative views of financial practices such as speculation or short selling, etc. But it's very clear that they don't actually understand what speculation is or how short selling allows financial markets and the market economy more generally to adjust to changes in the economy far more quickly than it otherwise would. And these are all very important things, because it's the old adage, right? You should be very careful before talking about something if you don't know very much about that subject.
Well, let's talk about
the lesson that these people from the medieval and early modern period give us is that if you want to talk about finance, if you want to explore these things and make commentary and give moral guidance in this area, then you probably need to understand how it works.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. There's a obvious education gap to a certain extent between those in the church who are dealing with morality and ethics and giving guidance, mainly the clergy, you know, even academics, and the world of finance.
Especially academics.
Yeah. I mean, finance is so complex these days. How is that gap bridged? I mean, what are some strategies of giving some moral guidance to the financial world from the church?
Well, it sounds like the Purpose of Acton Institute. Sounds like the role of Acton Institute right there, yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's part of it. I think part of it is that what you do find among many Catholic clergy and other Christian clergy as well is that there's very little understanding of economics, just generally speaking. Economics is seen as the realm of mammon. Economics is seen as something that concerns the material world. And, of course, remember, most clergy are in the business of receiving money. They're not in the business of creating wealth. That's what the rest of us do. And if wealth creation is a very different business from wealth distribution. So I think that's part of it. So the clergy can grow to understand that you can't even begin to think about questions of economic justice. You can't even think about questions of how do we realize our responsibilities to the poor in the material realm unless we're actually creating wealth in the first place? If there's no wealth created, there's nothing to redistribute. So I think that's a significant issue. The need for many clergy to have some understanding of basic economics and basic finance. And the Acton Institute, of course, we spend a great deal of time showing and teaching and explaining how modern market economies work to Christian clergy of all confessions. And we make the point that these things don't emerge in some sort of vacuum, that they do require a type of moral, ethical, and institutional, and legal, and political context. And often, I think, Christian clergy have a lot to say about those things because they draw upon the experience of the church, on the Catholic social teaching, which has several very important things to say about that subject. But I think that economic education of the clergy, I think, would go some way to resolving some of these issues. Now, I'm not saying that everyone who's a Catholic priest needs to have a deeply sophisticated understanding of economics, or that they need to be checking out what's going on in financial markets all the time. But they probably do need to have a little bit of grasp of how economies work, and also what it is that people who work in finance actually do, because I think it's very clear that a lot of clergy don't know what people working in the financial sector, or who are entrepreneurs, or who are working in banks, they don't actually know what it is that they do. So I think that is that's a big part of filling the gap. And I think on the flip side is that we have to realize that life in a market economy, life in the financial sector, is not somehow immune from the demands of morality, that the church has a whole moral teaching that's applicable to the way that we live our lives, not just our family lives, not just our marriages, not just all the other things, but also our economic lives, and that the principles of morality that we find in the Gospels, or we find in the natural law, are just as applicable to the world of the economy as it is to every other aspect of life. And that, I think, is what the church really has to offer. Guidance about how one lives the good life, how one does good and avoids evil in the conditions of modern market economies, in which the financial sector is a very big component, precisely because the financial sector, they are really the engineers of capital. They are the ones who put capital to work so that it benefits more than just the people who actually own it, but everyone.
You know, one of the things I really appreciated about your book was how you began to, you've interwoven this notion of the common good, vocation, the emergence of banking and finance. One word that comes up, though, Dr. Greg, that I think it's really misunderstood, and I'd like you to talk about it a little bit, is this whole word profit. Profit seems to have it's almost like radioactive at times, it seems, but I think that's because it's likely profoundly misunderstood. What is it, the pursuit of it, and it is often equated with greed, but I don't think that to me seems like a profound misunderstanding. Can help us understand profit motive, and put that into Catholic context or a Christian, broader Christian context.
Well, there's nothing particularly mysterious about profit. In fact, in his third social encyclical, St. John Paul II wrote about this issue. He talked about the nature of profit, and he said, the encyclical is Concessimus Annus, you can get it from the Vatican website. And he makes the point there that what is profit? Profit is usually a sign that a business is functioning properly, because a business that is not making a profit clearly has a problem. It clearly has a problem because it's clearly not meeting consumer needs. It's clearly got problems in that, in the sense that it's probably got some internal inefficiencies and disorganization. And profit is usually a sign that the business is functioning well, that it's meeting consumer demand, and that it continues to be able to generate enough revenue to not just pay for the functioning of the business, but to generate more capital that can be then further invested to make the business and the rest of the economy grow. So profit itself, I think, in economic terms, is a sign of good things. Now, that doesn't say that, for example, you could be running a very profitable, I don't know, pornography business. So that's an instance in which, for example, the activity itself is so deeply immoral that it doesn't matter how much profit you make. because the activity itself is deeply, deeply morally evil. But generally speaking, profit in businesses that are engaged in entirely legitimate activities is a good thing. That's a very important thing to keep in mind. Now, I think what happens is that people mix up profit-seeking with materialism and greed. Wanting a business to function properly, wanting a business to meet consumer demand, wanting a business to be able to grow the amount of capital that it creates, none of that is a sign of greed. Greed is when you value something much more than it otherwise should be. So the question of profit, I think, is quite different from greed. Is it possible to get greedy about profit? Absolutely. But greed and profit in themselves are quite different things, and we shouldn't look askance at profit, because usually profit means that things are going well, both for the business, but also for the people that it employs and the people that it who created it in the first place.
We need to take a short break right now, and we'll be right back with more of the Catholic Cave right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
An interview with Brother Trenton Rout and how Catholic radio influenced his vocation.
I was not struck by lightning and knocked off my horse. I had a lot of time driving in the car listening to the radio, and I just got to a point where I would prefer to listen to something that would be intellectually stimulating. At the same time, I was learning about the faith, having that accessible, particularly the apologetics.
Catholic Radio, building faith, building vocations.
We're here with Dr. Samuel Gregg, author of For God and Profit, and discussing the origins of capitalism from a Catholic world back in the 11 and 1200s and how that's developed. With a lot of the emphasis that's been on social justice and the social encyclicals from the Church, a lot of Catholics, I think, have a misunderstanding that what the Church is really advocating is some form of state socialism, or more and more of a welfare state to be able to take care of the poor. And, you know, if somebody advocates capitalism, they're really advocating a neglect of the poor and a neglect of those in need.
A kind of selfishness.
A selfishness, but more importantly, a neglect of those in need within our society. How does capitalism, banking, finance, etc., how is that actually a way of living out the Church's social teachings?
Well, the first thing to keep in mind is that the Church is actually, in its social teaching, relatively critical of the welfare state. You find that criticism articulated in the social encyclicals of John Paul II, as well as Benedict XVI, there's a certain degree of criticism of the welfare state. I think what you find in the social encyclicals is a basic affirmation of the foundational institutions of what we call the market economy. So private property is affirmed. It's not absolutized, but it is affirmed. Free exchange is affirmed. The notion that there are limits upon what the government can and should do in the economy is also affirmed in Catholic social teaching, most notably through the principle of what's called subsidiarity, which generally means that social problems should be dealt with by the group that is closest to the problem, rather than automatically looking to the state or Washington, D.C. or Brussels to fix a problem that's happening at a very local or even regional or state level. So I think you're right. Catholic social teaching does have this reputation for being somewhat sort of mildly social democratic. But I think when you look at the encyclical tradition over time, and this year I should mention is the 125th anniversary of the first social encyclical, Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, what you do find is what I call an affirmation of the basic institutions of the market economy, but also some very tough things said about the welfare state, and right from the very beginning, I must say, a very sustained critique and critical view of socialism. If you read Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum, which was promulgated in 1891, the first part is all about condemning socialism. And it says socialism destroys private property, it destroys families, but above all, it's fundamentally materialistic and therefore atheistic. And I think that's often forgotten today, just how critical the Church and Catholic social teaching
is of socialism. So the church doesn't say that the state has no role in the economy. It does have a role in the economy. The church doesn't say that private property rights are absolute. It doesn't say that. What it does say, that there are forms of property rights that need to be respected. It doesn't say that you can freely exchange absolutely everything, like human beings or human lives, but it does say that free exchange is the normative way in which people engage economically. It also portrays business in itself as being a completely noble vocation and something that should be affirmed and celebrated as a vocation. You find that in John Paul II, you find that in Benedict XVI, and interestingly, Pope Francis has referred to business as a potential noble vocation. So all those things, I think, point in the direction of a relatively favorable view of the market economy, a relatively favorable view of capitalism, and a relatively skeptical view of socialism and excessive government intervention in the economy.
This notion of finance as a vocation is it's something I hadn't heard before and hadn't encountered until I read your book. Talk a little bit about that. What sets finance and capitalism apart to a certain extent from some of the other vocations or some of the other ways that we talk about vocation within the church?
Well, vocation, of course, means calling. That's what it literally means. It means a calling from God to perform some sort of service. And we all have a vocation. Everyone has a vocation. For some people it's priesthood, for some people it's religious life. But most of us, our vocation lies in the world. It lies in the world of being politics or economic life, being a father, being a mother, being a husband, being a wife. Everyone has a vocation. And I think with the question of finance, what you find is that while there are many people who are prepared to say, well, look, okay, I understand that finance is necessary. I understand that finance is something that is important if we want to grow the economy, if we want to have wealth creation. But I think it's just basically more or less a useful thing rather than something that is potentially a calling. And one of the things I try and do in the book is say that the vocation of finance, the vocation of banking is to, and the expression is shocks some people, is to make money good. To make money good. And what I mean by that is that not some sort of prosperity gospel. I'm not saying that money is a good in the sense that it's just as or more important than human life or beauty or friendship or work. Rather, it's that money's very nature is such that it can be very quickly redirected to helping to realize the good. So finance is a vocation, what might be called the engineering of money in the form of capital. It has immense potential to contribute to the common good. It enables us to employ people and thus promote work, to build hospitals and therefore promote life, to create companies, businesses, and thereby facilitate human creativity and relationships. Money gives us power over resources, material resources, human resources, and it gives us the power to direct, organize, consume, and be creative with those resources. And that, I think, is a quite important vocation. Make the same point negatively. Think about a world in which there was no capital formation or there was no financial sector, where we effectively just treated money purely as a means of exchange. Well, I think you'd find that the result would be most likely an economy in which most people were very poor and, above all, unable to become socially mobile. It would be very difficult for people to make long-term savings, to obtain credit, to start businesses, or to sustain big businesses that employ thousands of people over long periods of time. Without the finance as a vocation, we would be quickly very back in a situation where we're living in an economy that existed of the type that existed before the Middle Ages, a subsistence level economy where there are a couple of very wealthy people, but where everyone else is living a hand to mouth existence. So on the one hand, a world obsessed with finance is certainly a very unhappy world, but so too would be a world without finance. Without finance, we would have fewer opportunities, our choices would be more limited, and we'd be more vulnerable to the whims of time and chance and circumstances. Now, while it's true that people in finance can make some serious mistakes that damage the well-being of lots and lots of people, and we saw some of that in 2008 with the Great Recession, without finance, without those who are skilled in what I often call financial engineering and creativity, we would face the prospect of largely subsistence economies and greatly reduced opportunities for human flourishing.
Well, our guest today has been Dr. Samuel Gregg, the Director of Research at the Acton Institute. You can catch him. You write a lot of articles. I love seeing those in Catholic World Report, Crisis Magazine, Public Discourse, obviously the Acton Institute website. You're the author of many, many books. These are really wonderful. I highly recommend Becoming Europe, one of my favorites. Tea Party Catholic, the title alone should draw people in to buy that one. I find that just a fascinating case for limited government and liberty. But also something, another book that I also highly recommend of yours is Unordered Liberty, and the other one is A Commercial Society. But today we've been talking about your latest, and I have to say greatest book, For God and for Profit, How Banking and Finance Can Serve the Common Good. So, Dr. Gregg, we just got a minute or two left. What's on this? Is congratulations again on the book. Fascinating. What's on the horizon for you?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing I'll say, the title of the book, For God and Profit, it's not something I came up with myself. You found this was the expression that was written in the ledgers by merchants and bankers. In the medieval world, they would write this, for God and profit was the expression that they would use in the legends. And they did this because they believed that what they were doing was a noble vocation. So I think for the next few months, I'll be spending a lot of time promoting and talking about this book, For God and Profit, as a way of trying to bring this understanding of the financial sector and banking and finance to Catholic audiences and other Christian audiences, because it seems to me that without this understanding, without this enhanced understanding of what the financial sector is and what it can do and its potential, I worry that many in the church will continue to talk about this in a way which indicates that they don't really know what they're talking about. I'm very happy to say also that the book's foreword is written by Cardinal George Pell, who's the prefect for the Secretariat of the Economy in Vatican City, and he's the man that was brought in really to clean up the Holy See's finances. And this is a man who clearly understands finance, but also understands that finance can be a vocation. So I think for the next few months, what we'll be doing is spending a fair amount of time promoting this book and showing that it's a way for Catholics and other Christians to rethink how we understand finance in modern market economy.
Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Dr. Gregg. We appreciate it. We appreciate all you do. And we're going to have you back on the show again. These are always very fascinating conversations we have.
Oh, you know what? We want to lay a little plant a little seed with you, too, Dr. Gregg. Now, we had Professor Patrick Deneen on recently.
Yes.
And we understand that the two of you would maybe have some different views on the economy and the American project, and maybe we'll find a way to sort of bring you two together for we might call a cage match of ideas.
Well, you're not the first person that suggested that. Quite a few people have suggested that, and I know Professor Deneen. I admire his work on all sorts of levels. He's a very good example of what I think a Catholic scholar should be. And he and I have some different perspectives on the American Revolution, the American founding, and the nature of the market economy. But I very much respect him as a man, as a Catholic, as a scholar, and I'm always very happy to have the type of engagement that you're discussing.
Great. We love to have, the philosophy in large part is the contest of ideas and in pursuit of the truth and love of wisdom. So thank you again for being on our show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We need to take a short break right now, and we'll be right back with more of the Catholic Cave right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Since 1968, the Motion Picture Association of America has been rating movies based on violence, language, sexual content, etc. But what if their judgment as to what's appropriate for your family is different from yours? Wouldn't it be nice to get a second opinion? Maybe one from a Catholic perspective. Catholic News Service and the former Office of Film and Broadcasting of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops have teamed up to continue the tradition of giving every movie a rating, one that you might find much more appropriate for your family. Where can you find these ratings? The easiest place is right on our website, CatholicRadioIndy.org. Right on the opening page, just look for the yellow Movie Ratings tab. When the kids ask, hey, can we go to the movies? Or you just want to go yourself, check out the Catholic Movie Ratings at CatholicRadioIndy.org. It never hurts to get a second opinion.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell. Still in the cave, Mark Tuttle and Kent Blanford. And we just had the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Samuel Gregg, the Director of Research at the Acton Institute, about his new book, For God and Prophet. Mark, what did you make of that interview?
Well, this is such an important book, and it's such an important topic. I think a lot of people, they look at the world of finance, they look at the bankers, they look at what's going on Wall Street, and all they see is Gordon Gekko, you know, for the character from Wall Street, the movie. Yeah. You know, greed is good. Yeah. And really, when you get down to it, a virtuous society needs to have a financial sector behind it. And I think Dr. Gregg made that point.
Made a strong case for it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because without wealth and without the ability to use that wealth for good, you can't have the poor being taken care of, whether it's through a welfare state or whether it's through lending and investment and the growth of more business opportunities and things. You have to have that to be able to take care of the poor in your society and to be able to have the opportunities to provide for all of those that can't provide for themselves.
I think you're absolutely right. The other thing that really resonated with me too was this, I almost would characterize it as his call to action for all of us who are not as informed as we should be, which is he mentioned several times about a lot of people talk about finance. And to your point, Ken, kind of this sort of sloganeering, I would call it, these railing against the Wall Street machine. But at the same time, he's called us to a call to action about going deeper into let's before we do that. Pass judgment, if you will. Let's make sure we really understand our financial systems. Let's make sure we understand banking. Let's understand the vocation of working in that particular part of the economy and its history, especially our Catholic and Christian history as it pertains to that. And we might find that, yes, we're still, of course, against greed, but greed and profit are not the same thing. It was something he talked about. And I just thought that really resonated. We have to become better educated, more informed, before we formulate and articulate positions.
And the world of finance isn't the only world where, you know, that's the case.
We could go on and on.
Exactly.
And lots of subjects.
You know, whether it's bioethics and the world of medicine, whether it's science and scientific
pro-life
exploration,
yeah,
whether it's pro-life, there's more and more, I think, of a technical specialization that goes on where the practitioners in those areas, obviously, they have a lot more knowledge than the church and those of us that kind of think through the ethics and morality around those. And that's part of the purpose of the cave, is to try to bridge that gap a little bit of education, try to help our listeners to kind of learn a little bit more about some of these topics so that they can be better informed Catholics and really allow the Holy Spirit to work in these realms. And the world of finance is one of those realms where a lot of people kind of say, what does the Holy Spirit have to do with money?
Right. Well, thank goodness Dr. Gregg wrote this book. It's a tremendous aid to those very purposes that you mentioned, Mark. So again, run out and get it, For God and Profit, How Banking and Finance Can Serve the Common Good. You will really, really appreciate it. And when you've got Cardinal Pell as writing the foreword for your book, you know that this is solid, solid good stuff.
Well, guys, that's all the time we have for The Cave for this week. We'll hope to see y'all next week right here on Catholic Radio Indy. For Mark Tuttle, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and for myself, Kent Blanford, have a great week. May God bless us all.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Catholic Cave. If you have a question or comment regarding this program, please address an email to Kent, K-E-N-T, at CatholicRadioIndy.org or call 317-870-8400. Replays of this program are available on podcast at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Just click on the programming tab, then go to podcasts of local programs.